ammunition, become a pillbox. Out of ammo, become a bunker. Out of time, become podcasters. The movie is The Beast of War, directed by Kevin Reynolds, 1988. You've come to The Real War Project.
This podcast contains explicit language and plot spoilers.
I'm here with my pal, the doctor, Aaron Donaldson.
I think the tank is the mother, Charles. That's what I think Sigmund Freud would say, is that the tank is the mother.
Mm-hmm. The safety? The safety is on the inside in the womb of the tank, is that?
Yeah, exactly right. Nobody cares what Freud would say. That's what I always say. Charles, we just watched a movie that I had never even heard of, but this movie is like, holy cow, it's so wild. It's a great comparison to The Man Who Would Be King. Last time we talked about the efforts to kind of like represent otherness from the lens of empire. This movie's doing that like 10 years later in a very different vocabulary with many of the same pitfalls, I would say, but in a very, very different way. Like, how did you find this movie? Why did you put this on the list? Like, what a find.
I found this. I was listening to... God, I don't know what. I don't know if this just came up because I was looking for tank movies or whatever, and this just pops up in people's conversations. But I feel like I was listening to another veteran podcast called Hell of a Way to Die, and they had mentioned it in passing on there. And I just have been curious about it ever since, because it's got a solid cast. It's got the frickin' cinematographer to Full Metal Jacket. You know, it's got the director of frickin' Count of Monte Cristo, which is one of my effing favorite movies.
The one music
with Guy Pearce. And music by Mark Isham. Like, what the hell? It's got, like, these synthesizers and everything, but they're also mixed in with...
The Hollywood indigenous, we would say, the capital I quotes, yeah. Indian, I think.
But something that I had only kind of associated with, I think, Hans Zimmer-ish post-Gladiator type things, like that kind of Gladiator sound. But this has it in there, and this is such an early, much earlier movie.
I sent you a list of all of the movies that this person, Mark Isham, has done the music for. I'm pretty into soundtracks and things. There's so many people who have done so many wonderful...
Aaron and I got our minds blown by this because this guy does a legendary Montana movie.
He does. Charles told me he did A River Runs Through It. Which just, whenever I hear that soundtrack, I'm right back there in the Little Blackfoot River. I grew up... Since 1990, there are 55 movies to this person's name, and this movie, obviously, that we're watching was made in 88, and he's made movies before this, but just to give people some perspective of the list I found, this includes the movie Time Cop, best name for a cat ever, Blade, Life as a House, Racing Stripes, Crash, In the Valley of Elah, which I think we're going to watch on this show, 42, The Express, Bill and Ted Face the Music, and Judas and the Black Messiah, which just came out.
I watch that on an airplane.
You said that this soundtrack is synthesized. It definitely is. We ought to be able to hear. I don't know that it's going to come through on your mic, but we'll definitely drop it. But you should be able to hear it through the Zoom, Charles, if this is working today. I played it for my son, and as soon as I hit play, I asked him, like, what does this sound like to you? And he kind of listened to it, and I want to say it was like 3 seconds in. He looks at me and he goes, oh, someone's hunting something. It sounds like someone's hunting something. And this dude's like 4. And I'm like, it does. It's so 80s, and it is like pulpy 80s. This feels like, I said, it almost feels like the setting of an evening scene for a Lethal Weapon movie, in that it could be like downtown Miami with neon lights. But like you said, it
this
works
could be like
for
Blade
this.
Runner, yeah.
Sure, yeah. But it,
like a Vangelis soundtrack. Yeah, it's...
It totally works for this movie somehow, though, because this movie is set in a desert, a nowhere space, as we call it. The soundtrack is not scary, which kind of makes it scary. Kate and I have talked about on the Alien Movie Project on our episode for the movie Alien, a very famous soundtrack for that movie. There's, you know, one of the songs, it doesn't sound scary at all, and that's what makes it so scary. And everyone knows, you know, the kind of simple music.
It
kind of
had like
sounds.
A ghostly feeling at times to things.
Yeah.
What a
soundtrack. What, like, incredible. The casting is very, very, very good. It's brutal. It's violent. It's racist for sure. But, you know, we would expect that. Like, I don't even know how to summarize The Beast of War, except it's about...
unintentionally way ahead of its time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, from production value to content to just like political economy in general. Like, holy cow. I want to know, in your mind, how does this movie situate with The Man Who Would Be King? Like, why are... you don't have to tell me what the batch is, because that's kind of half the game. But mm-hmm. like, why are these... what's the relationship between these two movies? Just one quick backwards look before we dig into this episode.
Surface level, I was thinking Afghanistan, but on another level, I was thinking technological over-reliance or overconfidence.
Yeah. Right.
You know, a contrast between technological might and indigenous peoples, I think.
Right.
Something along those right. lines.
There's definitely like white savior tropes going on, positionings of technology and empire with like indigeneity in each movie, for sure. In The Man Who Would Be King, it's rifles. In this movie, it's a tank.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's the T-55, you said. And before, what were they, Enfields? I can't remember.
In the other movie, it is a Martini Henry.
When we talk about the fetishization and the hyperfixation on technology, which is one of the key tropes of the national security war film, according to that great book, Movies, Mission, the National Security State that I'm reading, it takes a whole lot of shapes. And we see it in this movie and in the last movie as being positioned as like a kind of liberatory tool that doesn't have any real political agenda. I mean, the tank itself, not so much, but like the RPG, the weapons and things like that. How do you think the tank situates and the tank crew situate with relationship to like the Strategic Air Command and the bomber crews and things like that, right?
I mean,
suicide missions, mm-hmm. similar like out exposed, very, very different tonalities, right? And valences in terms of the movie's orientations. But what do you think?
Well, right away, we have a scene in Beast of War after the initial horrors, where we see a character straddling the barrel mm-hmm. as if it's a giant penis.
I need a woman!
It's like it's saying right there. And Dr. Strangelove said it right there. And and Strategic Air Command can't help but just relish on just long language shots of aluminum penises flying through the air. So,
and just the most beautiful music, romantic music you will ever hear.
Yeah, it's in the same ways that Ripper in Dr. Strangelove whips the newspaper off of his desk to reveal a gun that threatens people. You know, the tank is a horrible, threatening, terrifying weapon in this mm-hmm. this movie. But strangely enough, it's also operated by people that are so scared. It's really quite interesting because we've also just kind of been talking, you know, I don't think we've watched enough movies to really formulate this idea fully, that war movies are kind of like a horror film in which, you know, you get to know people and then they get killed off until you yeah. have a hero at the end.
The monster's coming for them at some point, mm-hmm. right?
And in this movie, it's both the tank, but then also the people hunting the tank. You know, it's like the people hunting the tank are like Jason. No matter how far the tank drives, they're just always on the horizon. Or they're like in Butch Cassidy, you know, they're like the Pinkertons who are mm-hmm. just always on the horizon. And they're like, who is that dude? That guy must yeah. be like this legendary Pinkerton that I've heard about. But you never even see him. He's just always like dust on the horizon that just never lets them rest. Like mm-hmm. the Mujahideen in here and the villagers are always just like to the tank crew, just like these dots in the mirage that are just always, always pursuing them. But then at the same time, they're also totally deserving of this hunting. Like it's the movie lays it out right from the beginning that they absolutely deserve this. And the movie clearly morally sides with the villagers of Afghanistan.
this movie came up in a couple of articles, not a whole lot, and it's really just mentioned more as an example than any kind of analytic, but it's in a journal called Perspectives on Terrorism, April of 2015. This article, Samuel Betwee's Transnational Cinematic Perspectives of Terrorism, and it just lists this movie as one of many in the 80s that kind of demonstrates that when America renders terrorism, we tend to side with the so-called like freedom fighters quite a bit. And this is just another movie that really does that. We side with the Mujahideen and the Afghanistani rebels. From the very beginning, they demonize the tank crew in just really horrific ways. Anton is the white savior. I texted you, Anton wants to kill the tank even more than the Mujahideen do at the end, because they're just most of them are happy with the helicopter. Taj is a little disappointed, but Anton wants vengeance, and that's ultimately, I think, what gets the bulk of the people there, because he's like dragging people along. This movie does not tell us at all what the war is about. The tank just shows up and starts slaughtering innocent people in a scene that I said may as well just be American drones, like, you know, doing the exact same thing right now. What does this movie say about soldiers and soldiering? Anton thinks for himself. Anton fights the good fight. Anton uses his ability and knowledge of soldiering for the cause of justice, and that's what makes him good. But power corrupts, and often weak people are in positions of leadership, and soldiers are terrible people. Something like that.
Yeah, I think it shows that Anton is Jason Patrick in the movie.
Right.
It implies that he has been previously punished for thinking for himself. Like, he has been insubordinate in the past and has been knocked all the way down now into being in a tank crew.
Sounds like Americans critiquing Soviets to me, Charles. In many ways, it's very 1980.
So he goes from military intelligence, apparently, to some sort of rescue unit, and then eventually now to this tank crew. And this downward trajectory of his career is used as a threat against him in order to get his compliance as a tank crew member. We do see that. That's like another thing from our very first episode, where it's somebody acting upon threat of personal violence to themselves. We're also talking about the morality of refusing orders. He's not a pacifist, obviously, in this movie. He's not choosing necessarily just not to fight, but he also chooses not to kill, is what dooms him, I think, later on, you know, because he won't kill Samad.
He won't kill Samad, and he won't kill Daskal. They literally put Daskal's blood all over the women of Afghanistan. The women show up in this movie. They do a lot of wailing at the beginning, which is pretty typical for these kinds of movies, we've said. But they do. They show up and encourage the men to fight. They get told that they can't fight. And in a way that was kind of evocative to a conversation Kate and I had in the Alien Movie Project about Men in Black, it's like right after the alien or the monster has been almost killed, or we think it's been killed, that's when the woman shows up to do the final thing. And so in Men in Black, it's like Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith have just fought the huge cockroach, and Tommy Lee Jones shot his way out of it, but it was a fakey. The alien shows up behind him for a double scare moment, and that's when the Undertaker character, whose name I'm forgetting, she finally kills off the alien. You get it? And so it's like the men hunted and wounded and did most of the fighting of the beast, but she's the one that finishes it off. And that's kind of what we see in this movie, too. And ultimately, they really like really relish killing Daskal. And, you know, they bookend it that way on purpose. Like the beginning of this movie, Daskal tells them to drive a tank over a prone prisoner of war as a demonstration of what happens to rebels.
Yeah, let's get into it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Let's do it.
Jesus Christ. Yep. So The Beast of War, 1988, directed Kevin Reynolds. This is based on a play, Nana Watai. Yeah. I'm curious about this play. They said that the women in there are kind of like a chorus in there, and it does.
I told you there are 20 people in this movie, and it feels like there are 20 casted or credited characters, and it just feels like more than that. It really does. The tank crew's five people: Daskal, Constantine, Golikov, Kaminsky, and Samad. Those are your tank crew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you pretty much have just like a handful of locals, you know, the Mujahideen and then the villagers, and that's it. Like, it's really a very small group of people.
The Russians are played by Americans. The Afghanistanis are played by folks from India and Cuba and lots of other places in like real kind of typical Hollywood brown face.
Yeah,
form.
It's shot in Israel, so there's probably some local
Israelis as well,
in there.
Right? Yeah. Stephen Barr, is that how you say that? He plays Kontage Bauer, sure, yeah. He plays El Eladio in Breaking Bad. That was in Better Call Saul. That was the last time I'd seen him in something. Hmm. I knew he looked familiar.
I recognized him from Scarface. He's Scarface's buddy in there.
Yeah, everybody probably. I saw he was in Scarface, and I'm like, I bet yeah, people know him from that too. Interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right around that time period too. So it's like he's at peak handsome. It's yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
It's delicious. It's delicious to see, but we don't get to see him yet. We get some people. We get some local rural life. It is a deserted wasteland. Like I said, this is not shot in Afghanistan. I feel like we have learned now from all of our news coverage of the last 20 years that Afghanistan has a lot of trees, and at worst it looks like Southern California, tree-wise, and not like the Death Valley parts. I don't know. Maybe it does.
This looks like Tantooine. Maybe it does. To me is kind of what it like
that seems to be what they're implying. It's just like it's really this is the dustiest place, but we hear immediately the sound of jets. There are explosions all over the village. And then we see a bunch of tanks rolling through the desert. It says 1981, second year of the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. And we just see three tanks just absolutely lay waste to a village.
Yeah, a lot of people running around screaming, helpless. They do have some very, very basic, simple weapons that one of them tries to fire. I think he misses, and before he can get his second shot off, the tank just blows up the thing.
Well, see, that
dude shows up later.
Mm-hmm. And that guy's pretty badass. Like, he is the Khan of the town, I believe. Mm-hmm. And he has some experience with a recoilless rifle, although sadly he does miss the tank. But he is operating under pressure, and he is operating a crew-served weapon just by himself. You know, he should be aiming and just firing, and somebody else should be reloading and unloading for him. So he has a hard time.
Demonstrably asymmetrical warfare, like way over the top in terms of the
one
power
dude who
capabilities
knows what he's doing
Russians
is not enough.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
We see women run around the corner. They stone a tank. They climb on top, and they are banging it with stones in anger. And then a hatch opens up underneath, and somebody just drops out like a gas canister.
Yeah, and one of them just stays there and keeps hitting the tank and like dies as a result. And then gets flopped off when the dude opens the top of the tank out.
Yep, and then the tank crew dismount, and then they just start finishing off the town with guns, flamethrowers, and RPGs.
And it's never explained. It's never. They do say that this is what happens to rebels. So they're insinuating that this is like a rebel stronghold. But that
somebody
just,
also said later on that this was in retaliation.
Right. And yeah. There was one brief mention that said that was about retaliation. Right. But otherwise, there's absolutely no indication as to why this is happening. This is just how the movie starts, and it's huge. It's really big. The budget for this movie, we said, was $8 million. According to the IMDb, it made, what, $160,000? Ouch. Someone lost a bunch of money on this movie. Yeah, but, like, you see it. That $8 million, it's not spent on the 20 characters. It's spent on pretty amazing, like, pyrotechnics, I would say. This tank shoots a lot, and when it does, it's for effect.
A guy runs up to a house, and he just torches it with a flamethrower, and then a guy runs out of the building on fire and falls to the ground and dies. Yeah. Another guy takes an RPG, loads it, and just fires it at the minaret of a mosque and blows it up.
Yeah, that was a really matter-of-fact demolition. I thought that that was an interesting detail that they put in there, and just how with the mask on, it really depersonalized everybody and made everyone just look extra uncaring. But he just kind of looked at it, loaded it, fired, took the thing down. It just seemed like, again, like if this is a, you know, maybe there's a sniper up there or something. I don't know. But it's like, if this is a war, like what's the point of that? They're just, it just seems really wanton to me. They're just destroying everything.
Yeah. Yeah. We later on, I learned as I was rewatching that, that is, that's our hero, Kovachenko, because he does have the,
how interesting.
Yeah. He does have the extra rocket pack on his back when he goes running after the extra tank. So that then explains why he knows so much about the RPG. Although maybe if he had also had the RPG tube and dropped that with the sack when he ran up on the tank, maybe that would have been obvious. There's probably a longer shot, but they're like, you know, let's cut this down. Let's keep this under 2 hours. We don't need to hold that for an extra 5 seconds just so that we can see that it's all right. We'll get that he knows what he's doing when we see him fix it and it works.
Right.
So there's just dead civilians everywhere, just in the foreground, you know, like it would be you seeing like the crew, you know, talking to each other and stuff. And you'll just see like somebody's foot in the foreground and, you know, a handkerchief blowing across it, a headdress or something. It's now, pretty quite
they pick
effective.
Up the basket of food and that's the handkerchief that blows by, right?
Yeah,
and
it's like dead civilians are just everywhere. And then we have some resistance from the town. Some guys jump right up onto one of the accompanying tanks and kicks the tank commander right in the head and then Molotovs the interior of it. Another Molotov hits the tank with our with Deskal, our tank commander. And he turns around and guns that guy down and then clears off the other tank. Kovachenko, which is Jason Patrick, runs over to help the burning tank and is unable as men scream on the inside. Let's see. His name is Shazaman. This guy has the drop on Jason Patrick, and he has one of those old flintlock rifles. And Jason Patrick knows his jig is up, and he gets click. Oh, the thing doesn't go off. And the guy is like looking at him like, oh, you lucky bastard. You know it. You know I had you. And he then gets whacked by Kaminsky, I believe, the gunner.
Right. Right.
And that guy is like, you better. You owe me. One.
And it would be interesting to think how this movie would have ended if that dude would have shot Anton. Like, that would have been a bad ending to this movie, because Anton was pretty essential to them destroying the tank. But
yeah, he really helped out.
Yeah, it was through all of that, especially the fighting between the tanks, that that's when I sent you that text that's like, this movie feels like some kind of combination of Black Hawk Down and Saving Private Ryan, but obviously just way before those movies. It's a very 80s movie, but it does not feel like an 80s movie at all. The soundtrack feels 80s-ish, but somehow works. And I don't know, just really compelling. Really, like, gruesome. The beginning of the movie is really, really gruesome, I would say.
It's none of it is portrayed like cool. You know, no, it's all portrayed as being a cruelty.
Yeah.
Now we get truly a cruelty. We get the guy that just got, that just misfired his rifle, and he gets dragged over to the tank. And Deskal, well, one of the guys says, we're going to squash you like a grape. As they're dragging him over, we get a bunch of women screaming. They come over. They are trying to stop this from happening. We have an interpreter, so we have he interprets, but he's also the tank navigator, and he is an actual Afghani who has joined the Communist Party of Soviet Russia or whatever and has gone to like a university or something and is now in the military.
Yeah, played by Eric Avari, a famous Indian actor that you'll see in lots of movies.
He's a that guy.
Yeah, he's definitely a that guy.
The Mummy, baby. Yep.
And they're calling him a traitor. They're attacking him. And telling him that he should kill the commander, and then he turns to the commander, and he's like, these women respectfully ask that you, like, give the prisoner back, right? Like, his translation is in full deference to the you know, the patriarchy and the the empire and all of that.
He tells them this commander prefers bullets to words. And then Daskal tells them to watch what happens to rebels or whatever.
And they make a real moment of putting the toes and the feet, the sandals, right up against the tread. They really put position it deliberately. They fixate on it deliberately.
The guy himself moves himself under there. He knows what they're gonna do, right? And he doesn't fight it. He just it's really interesting. He scoots under there and then he just holds eye contact with Kovachenko.
They say because he's going to paradise, so he's not afraid.
Right, and he and it's just kind of I suppose that sneering in the face of death, you know, because he knows that at least he died, I guess, defending a pretty much defenseless town. Sure. And these guys should, if there's any sort of justice, be going to hell for this.
It was just a really vivid image.
Do it, Kovachenko.
I was going to say, Daskal has to give the order a couple of times, to the point where he grabs Kovachenko by the hair and shakes his head and commands him then, and then the tank moves forward and you see just a split second of his feet underneath the tread as the tank moves forward. And I was like, oh fuck, please don't show any more than that. Thankfully they did not. That a cop-out? I don't know. I didn't want to see it.
I mean, they showed you what they did, and it cost quite a bit, and it took up, you know, pretty prominent space here at the beginning of the movie, and functions very deliberately in the movie, I think. Mm-hmm. I thought of my buddy Casey James, making fun of villains in movies, being like, give me a bin of puppies, and then he just crushes their skulls, because that's what the villain does, so that we can hate him for the entire movie. To me, I thought very, very immediately about the juxtaposition of technology, because these folks are on foot running the whole movie, through rocks and dust and stuff like that in their sandals. And then you've got this massive tank that can travel 30 miles an hour and go 350 miles between fill-ups and, you know, shoot however, you know, many shells it has and all of these things. And again, it's just a very, very deliberate and very, very asymmetrical and very, very demonizing move to be like, here's where we're at, right?
It's a metaphor, right? It's the image of the really tank visceral tracks literally smashing just sandals on native feet.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. No, that was this contact of two very, very distinct and variant levels of technology up against each other. And the outcome is pretty plain.
The outcome is plain, but the result is that even though you're rolling over the other guy effortlessly, he is resisting you to the very end.
Right. And of course, we get the shot of Daskal as the tank rolls over, kind of rocking back and forth, looking grimly satisfied. And we kind of come away, I don't know, I came away hating Anton. He was later, I had to do it. And to his credit, Samad's like, no, you always have a choice, man. You definitely had a choice, right? Again, every soldier out there, you always have choices. You have choices. You are a human. That means you have choices. Sorry.
Yeah. Yep. Nope. The tank goes to catch up with the rest of its column, and there is a fork in the road, and Daskal makes the wrong call to the driver, tells him to make a right-hand turn, and so they make a right-hand turn, and it's the wrong way. Mujahideen are watching, and they're like, oh, shit. He went the wrong way. They're lost. They know where it goes.
Yeah.
It was a big old dead end. They're going to have to come right back through there. And then we go back to the village, and we just see villagers mourning absolute total devastation. It's quite horrible. This is where we're going to meet Taj. We're going to see a lone naked baby. We are going to see burned bodies. We see villagers mourning devastation. We see bodies burned. We see what looks like news coverage from a modern airstrike. It's bad. People are screaming. People are catatonic in what they are looking at. We have some men returning with their rifles. Apparently, they weren't there when it went down. It's his Taj and his pals. And they are shocked by what has happened. Taj is apparently not a fighter, and he is pretty devastated by what he sees here.
So Taj comes back with his friends. As you say, he's clearly not a fighter. His uncle and this other sunglasses wearing guy are like, you know, we can change. They have a little bit of a fight over who's going to shoot the rocket, but they all agree that they're going to try to go kill the tank, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're like, I need to talk to the. He's like, I don't need to talk to you, Khan or Taj. I need to talk to the Khan. And they're like, oh, that's Taj's brother, and he's dead. He's the guy who got run over by the tank.
Right.
And so now it falls on the reluctant hero. This is part of the hero's journey. Mm-hmm. He has to kind of reluctantly do it. He's not going to be good at it. Luke Skywalker was not good at shooting RPGs right off the bat, you know?
It's just a bunch of whining, basically, about going to pick up some power converters or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
He sees the naked baby and hands it to, what was her name? Sharina? Sure.
Yeah. And is like, you be his mom now. You and she's just mother. Totally she's, catatonic.
Somebody else comes over and takes the baby from her. It's like, yeah, good. She doesn't want to be raising a baby right now. She wants to be raising a rock over somebody's head and then smashing it down on him.
Right. Because that was her husband. The Khan was her husband.
Yeah.
Right,
she was supposed to, they were to be tanks, married.
Right.
Yeah. Totally.
Right. Yeah. They're supposed to, right. Okay.
In fact, if there was a moment where there is a character cradling a baby and looking at the devastation like Bruce Wayne does in Batman versus Superman, this is the character I think that does it.
Like, yeah, there should be a real movie. Similar moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So from this point out, they just chase the tank through the desert is basically what happens. They almost catch it a couple of times.
Yeah, we learned that that they don't necessarily have the best relationship with Mustafa and the Mujahideen. He says a scavenger who picks gold from the teeth of dead Russians is, I guess, somebody that's not cool. I mean,
right.
I don't know.
But then he ends up wanting the helicopter, right? Is that the same guy that said that?
That's the same guy. The guy who picks the teeth
is the one
who wanted the helicopter.
Right,
what's funny about this movie, and this is a spoiler, is that later on they get a helicopter, and they just kind of like get the supplies from the helicopter. And because, you know, that's a hard thing to fly. And even if you don't know how to fly it and you have a free helicopter, you don't really want to learn in a helicopter. But
there's a time and a place for learning in the saddle. It usually involves saddles. And even then I'd be like, make sure it's an old horse.
But when we just recently left Afghanistan,
not a helicopter.
We left some helicopters behind, and and a lot of those guys have been trained in doing stuff, and they were immediately flying the helicopters around.
Helicopters and Humvees and weaponry and
I
all
just
sorts
hope that
of intelligence
still
equipment.
Under warranty. And
I was going to say warranty. Mm-hmm.
And as long as they respect the warranty and our company's property and
oh my God.
Then I think we can.
There's going to be a scandal in 2 years when we find out that the American taxpayers are servicing, like, you know, fucking Muslim Brotherhood equipment because it got sold to them secondhand by
somebody in a factory in Toledo, Ohio is making
we
carburetors.
We have to honor the warranty of the contractor that made it.
Oh, it'd be so good. Oh, it'll be so fucking
And
funny.
There's going to be a little pull quote from an administrator that's like, well, we can't disavow our warranty because that would hurt the brand.
The lady has picked up an RPG, and she wants to get in the fight. The guys just snatch the RPG and just dismiss her.
Right, she can't do it.
Yeah. We go, and the guys can't do it either, as we learn. And it turns out the woman's just like, well... The rest of the movie is her showing up, her eventually finding a discarded tank bomb, and then her and her friends dismantling it and wiring it perfectly to start a landslide.
Yeah, and somehow getting ahead of not only the tank, but also the other people that were chasing the tank at a dead sprint to be exactly where they needed to be right when the tank broke down.
Well,
like,
they
that
knew
was
exactly
pretty...
where it had to come right back through. Is that
well, yeah,
the
but
thing.
They didn't know where it was going to break down. Well, it was all pretty convenient. But
well, landed
can
right
I...
on the... Okay, well, we'll get there. We'll get there.
Well, yeah, but I do. I want to back up to the thing about nobody knowing how to use the rocket, because you and I talked in text about how, like, I understand that, like, I probably couldn't and probably wouldn't pick up an RPG and try to use it to shoot a tank because I don't know what I'm doing, and that's totally fine because I'm a civilian. But, like, this is, you said, 2 years into this war, and it's not a question of whether or not it is possible or even likely that no one would know how to use it. It's like, it's a fiction show. The choice was made to have absolutely nobody in the entire Afghanistani cast that can use this rocket. The one dude that says he can just, like, totally misses in like a kind of absurd way. And then it breaks and they don't even know what to do with it. And it's not a question of whether or not that's even likely. It's just that's a choice that they made that has some consequences, which situates Anton as like the necessary savior, right? Like he ultimately is what enables them to win the fight. They would never be able to do it without him. Their plan is ruined from the beginning and they don't even know it, right? Just because they don't know what to do with the weapons.
You know what? I'm going to say I disagree.
Okay.
I'm going to say that the movie proves that that probably they didn't need to do any of that. I mean, they definitely put the crew underneath a huge amount of stress.
Yeah.
But the tank was going to do what it was going to do no matter what. It was going to drive until it couldn't drive anymore and realize
because the
it went in
drinking
the wrong direction.
The brake fluid.
Right. And then it was going to have to turn around and go yet. All the way back the other way. And so truly, the women had the right idea where they know that it has to go back through this one
right.
little tiny spot to get
right.
to the fork.
Right.
And so it's like, well, we can just wait for it right here. Otherwise, I mean, they're just going to be stranded in the desert. So what does it matter?
That's a really good point. They spend a lot of time chasing the tank around when they know for a fact it's going to have to just do a U-turn and come straight back.
Right.
And, seems awfully exhausting. That's like one better than mine. Not only do they not know how to work an RPG, they're just going to go running through the desert for no reason at all.
Exactly. Right. They could have just set up the ambush for them knowing that that's where they had to go. I mean, I feel like that they realized that later on. But it's like even at the end, the final shot that they do with the RPG doesn't get the tank. It's truly the women who stopped the tank because they were smart enough to just hang out at the one spot they knew it had to go through and make a good plan.
Yeah.
Interesting. And disable it the way that you saw a tank get disabled early on, which is the Molotov cocktail.
Right.
A classic.
Yeah.
A tank boy classic.
Yeah, right. Talk about a piece of very basic technology with absolute staying power. Everybody likes to fixate on the AK-47, and I'm like, oh, sure, yeah, that's pretty cool, but let's just talk about that little bottle with the rag in it for a minute, because that thing is pretty basic and effective, I guess, is a term you could use.
It's legendary. It is legendary.
Affecting is a term you could also use.
We get the tank. The tank stops. Duskel is talking to Samad as to what the heck went on. We see that the map is all burned up from the Molotov cocktail attack. The radio is damaged from the Molotov cocktail attack. We'll learn that there are a lot of other problems going on with the tank later on. This is the beginning of, well, probably not the beginning, but this is the beginning of the end when it comes to suspicions versus Samad for being Afghani. Duskel fires him. We learn that Samad went to university.
That he doesn't think religious thoughts so much since university, but he still practices religion. He says that, like, as you pointed out, like his suffering is how he's gonna learn how to know all the things
such
about
a somber man.
When the old man gets on your back, there's no way to shake him off.
My dear Constantine, I regard this abuse as the price I must pay to learn. I love Afghanistan, but we are a flea in the tail of a bear. We must join the 20th century. When Afghans accept that, I will be there.
Samad's character, it made me think of, what was her name, Helen? Jimmy Stewart's wife from Strategic
Sally,
Air Command. Sally, that's it, you're right, yeah, Sally. Who's like later at the end, she's like, I'm sorry and I'm ashamed of myself. And everyone's like, no, you were right the whole time, Sally. You should just be on it. Samad is like similarly like self-effacing throughout this whole movie. Even though if they listened to him, they'd probably do a better job. I don't know. But yeah, Duskel doesn't trust him. This seems a lot like The Thing to me, where it's like, we don't know if he's one of us or not. The suspicion starts here and just kind of gets worse and worse. And I think it's interesting that Anton knows and says right away that like, you cannot possibly, or sorry, is it Anton or is it it's Constantine that says, like, right away, like, you can't escape this. Like, this dude's gonna,
you
gotta get out. Yeah, right.
The tank is a dick. There's also, there's a hand in the tracks. There's a leftover hand in there. That's yucky. Constantine has to reach in there and fish it out with his hand. They start getting, this is the first time they start getting fire from the pursuing Afghani, population. So we get an exciting exciting situation with this. We have a big time miss with the RPG. The RPG like hang fires. I feel like he pulls the trigger, it doesn't do anything, and then he's like, "What the hell?" And then it like fires as he has it like just kind of dangling there.
Yeah, so that's a good RPG explanation maybe for what happened. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. The
it looked
RPG
like he just shot it at the ground.
Yeah, the RPG is not behaving well, but also these guys just absolutely aren't trained with it. But, you know,
right.
Eventually they start dialing it in. They get better with it.
Sure.
Yeah. You know,
I would hope
practice.
So. Right. I mean, if the last 2 years weren't enough, I don't know how they're going to get that practice by the end of this movie. But
well,
hey.
So the problem is like when you're playing a battle royale, it depends on whether or not you even find one.
Right.
And so yeah. It's like, dang, I've been seeing these, but
every
like
time
I
you
said,
go near it, there's a camper somewhere just taking right. you out.
there's not a forgotten weapons channel in this mm-hmm. era where you can mm-hmm. watch a nerd teach you how to use an RPG.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which is a bummer. And right. I don't think the CIA at this point is teaching people how to use those RPGs.
Maybe they are. I don't know. This
don't
is
know.
Like 88, 81, 81,
well,
82.
Is,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Okay. Mm.
Yeah.
Hard to say. Not yet. Maybe not yet.
They miss. The tank speeds off. The locals split up. The Mujahideen leaves with the RPG. That's Mustafa and his men. Uh-huh. But the uncle and Taj just go after the tank, but the uncle is also wounded in his leg.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We see the we kind of get a cut to bleak desert. We see one of the Mujahideen running to a watering hole, and he
yep.
goes and starts drinking out of it. And then we see Taj come up, and he's sort of smiling, and then he sort of frowns, walks around a bush, and sees that there is a like a cyanide canister or something like that there.
Yeah, it's established early on that they poison the well. That's one of the things they do when they sack the town mm-hmm. is they dump one of those canisters right down
into the
well. I was
watching closely. It's Samad who puts it in the well. Shame on him.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh,
that's
dude.
Messed up, dude. Yeah.
Well, and he's the one that does this too because Descal's watching through the binoculars and he says only one of them drank the water. They found mm-hmm. the canister. Samad, I told you to throw that thing far away. And that was his like kind of like strike two, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I said Samad can't catch a break both for the canister and then for this next moment because the tank is not too far away. They're overwatching this position. And so they get ready to then shoot at the guys. And Samad has now been demoted off of what he used to do and finds himself handing a tank round to Kaminsky or whatever, who loads it into the thing. And then the tank round misfires.
Fire!
On the way. It's fire.
Go to manual.
Misfire.
Out of tank!
And Samad,
God, that'd be so scary.
They just look at Samad like it's his freaking fault just for touching it. Yeah. And all of the men bounce out of the tank. It's an incredibly tense scene as they try to like figure out what the
Come
heck
on.
They're going to do. Yeah.
That would be so scary. Like, how big is that round, Charles? Do you have any perspective on that? The thing's huge.
I think it's 105 millimeters, they said,
yeah.
for that. You know, the main
I mean,
battle
you don't want it going off in your lap.
Mm-hmm.
like,
yeah.
Bad news
like
bears.
That thing's probably like 35 pounds of, of propellant and whatnot and high explosive.
Right. Yeah.
They go and they take cover and then they discuss what's going on. The guys are like paranoid and then they're like, oh, Samad touched it. Mm. Samad touched the round. And then Kovachenko is like, well, it happens. One in every 100 is like a dud.
Right.
So that's not the case. And Kovachenko ends up going into the tank with Descal to unload the round.
Right. And that's where Descal confronts him, right, and says, why do you listen to him? Why do you believe mm-hmm. him?
Why do you
and
stick like, up for the Afghan?
Just tell me one thing, Kovachenko. Why do you stick up for the Afghan?
Because he's doing the best he can, sir.
That's what worries me.
Yeah, it's one of those interesting moments. I thought in that moment where it's like, if someone doesn't trust you, like, you know, one of the things I'm really interested in is the whole process of how we other people. How do I know who you are and all this? And we forget how big of a part of that is our own, like, impressions and work. And in this case, I thought like of a really common thing where if someone does not trust you, you cannot become trustworthy because everything that you do that is made to be trustworthy is just going to feed their suspicions because that's just what that person would do if they were trying to la, 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 la. And so it's like when he's like, that's just what I'm afraid of. It's like you cannot even be the good one. You know, it's like if like the whole, you know, Samad's character is supposed to be the model minority myth where he's going to work with the Empire to learn about the Empire, to be the bridge that connects the people to the Empire when the Empire has won the war and all of that. But the narrative here is pretty straightforward that you're not going to be trusted no matter what you do. And the better you do, the less trustworthy you are as a result of that. So I thought that was kind of an interesting line.
You'll just be rejected by both sides.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And Samad is very, again, in a very serene way, standing right on that boundary, taking credit, like hammer from all sides and just acting like, you know, that's the walk he has to take, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He gets called a traitor by the women. He's ultimately going to get shot by Daskal. I feel like he kind of sees both of these things coming. He's like, this is my lot.
Daskal does something interesting while he's in the tank with Kovachenko. He's like kind of appealing to Kovachenko. You know, he's like, hey, you know, I know you're a good troop. Let's keep your head on together. You know, you'll get your own tank someday or something like that. He sort of has that kind of dialogue with him. Kovachenko never seems to be interested in that.
Does it mean when he says you've got what it takes? That's what I wrote in my notes. You hear this a lot in movies, and it's frequently coming from the bad guy, right? And it's typically like to make the hard choice, right? To like do the evil deed.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what you're picking up here? Like when they say you've got what it takes, it's like to be the evil person in the cause of good or whatever.
Yeah, mission first, you know, without uncaring, pull the trigger without... worrying about the, I think that's what obviously it's what he wants from him. You know, when I say you've got what it takes, I'm asking for something different. I want somebody who's funny, who's going to entertain me.
Yeah. Or someone's that has like $25 when I need a $25 bottle of bourbon.
Exactly. They booby trap the round. So they put a grenade underneath the tank round. And then they drive off. They finally get the tank started. They drive off. One of the Afghanis goes to check on the round, and he gets blown up in a rather grisly way and is still alive. His arm is off. And one of the characters says, "We bleed because we are weak for Russian junk."
Yeah, and they think about leaving him, and then the guy decides to come back and mercy kill him. And Taj comes in, is kind of sad about that.
You know, I noticed that wasn't Taj that came right. Locked back. It was just one of the guys.
Yeah, well, it's the sunglasses guy whose name I can't remember.
Well, guy, Mustafa, comes back and kills him, and then just one of the other dudes walks back.
Oh, that
back.
Was not Taj that came back?
Yeah.
I thought
so
it was.
So I was like, oh, that's interesting. I was like, what an interesting little moment that they gave one of the other like kind of nameless guys a moment to mourn his buddy.
Right, yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, well, so this movie's got a lot of neat moments. They all add up to some interesting stuff. The guy says God is great, shoots him. We get a nighttime kind of the sun is setting. We see dogs chased off of that corpse by the women.
Mm-hmm. They set up a whole perimeter around
the women say
the
no village, only Badal.
Yeah.
There's some women that wanted to go back to the village. They aren't really down with this pursuit that the main lady has going on. That seems to be tertiary. There's another movie companion to this that just didn't get made, sadly, because this movie bombed at the three theaters that it was allowed to release at. So she says, no village, only Badal. And I'm like, hell yeah. Although, you know, revenge is bad, but, you know, damn, they freaking deserved it. The Afghani men come across a man dancing around a fire in kind of a bizarre sequence that sort of seemed otherworldly to a certain extent.
And he starts going on about David and Goliath, right? Mm-hmm. And how David has come to slay Goliath.
Mm-hmm. And it's like the guy has set a fire in this spot to illuminate the tracks of the tank so that the men can continue the pursuit of it. And it's just like a strange little moment.
Yeah, it served to, in my mind, to kind of like, again, to make the Afghani people like mystical, superstitious. I don't want to say primitivizing, but it is kind of that too in a lot of ways, because like the kind of the mystical person in the woods that guides your way through, like this is a trope you see a lot.
No, I was thinking Macbeth, that sort of thing.
Yeah, right, exactly. And he doesn't have any, he's kind of played as crazy or wild, right?
Although like, once they go rocker, on, he right? like goes, grabs something kind of off screen and goes and runs off with the men. Mm-hmm. As I noticed, as I was rewatching it.
Yeah, he's there for the rest of the movie. He follows him for the rest of the movie. But
yeah, so it's like he seems mystical, but then he totally is not. Like he's completely seemingly grounded. I thought it was interesting that, you know, they just use David and I mean, obviously you use David and Goliath, but it's not something that I would normally associate with being a Muslim thing. Or
that was kind of, yeah, my point was like, well, I mean, the whole movie is kind of just like a patchwork. That's what Hollywood's going to do, is it's all going to seem kind of Arab-y, right? Mm-hmm. That's how you get Cuban and Indian folks cast as Afghanistan people. I think I saw another thing that said like the women are speaking Hindi instead of, you know, whatever they're supposed to be speaking there. It's just, yeah, it's just, you know, they're just coddling it together so that it kind of gets the aura, not so much the actual
bummer
documentation.
The crew is attempting repairs in the night. We learn we have a moment with Samad and Kovachenko, where he's teaching him about his culture. Playing chess, hospitality, revenge, and sanctuary, or mercy. You know, and what's his name says? Kovachenko says, incredibly civilized.
It is called Pashtunwali. It's the code of honor.
Pashtunwali.
What are you doing? Now, three obligations. First, milmastia, hospitality.
Milmastia.
Second, badal, revenge.
Badal.
Third, nanawate, the obligation to give sanctuary to all those who ask.
Right. To all.
All.
Even the enemy.
Oh.
What if I kill your brother? And you come for badal, revenge. And I ask for nanawadi.
Then I would be obligated to feed, clothe, and protect you.
It's incredibly civilized.
It's a very good scene, I thought.
It is, and it isn't. It's like, I like the sentiment and think it's great. I think that there's, you know, a constant move in movies that are claiming to speak for otherness that is like, you have the main character or the hero of the movie is like, oh, you know what? You are actually civilized, which kind of like normalizes the expectation that they're not, or that that's where they have to kind of come from. And the argument is going to be that the characters themselves are manifestations of like the contemporary bigotry of the culture that they're supposed to be critiquing and things. But again, if you think about all of the movies that we have that represent terrorists from the 80s, right? And you've got like moment after moment after moment after moment where it's like, oh, you know what? They are actually people. Oh, they are actually people. It's like over time, this kind of aggregates to a narrative that's like they're not until we learn that they are. You
I
get
think
it?
The problem like, is that we never had movies where we were like, oh, they are actually people, because this movie didn't ever come out.
Sure. But in a world where you have none of that at all, and then you've got this as the alternative, you get it? It's like,
well, it's
better, but not much better.
what I like about this is that not only is that going on, though, is that in this same moment, this is also where Samad calls out Kovachenko for not refusing the order to run the guy over.
Why did you crush him?
Because I had no choice.
You always have a choice.
So right. It's like Kovachenko's being like, oh, wow, you are civilized. But I feel like it's more of a betrayal of, or showing, you know, showing Kovachenko's racism. That he also is coming from that point of view.
That's what I'm saying, where it's like, I get it that the character themselves has to be like the manifestation of the culture that the movie's critiquing. I get that. It's just like, it happens a lot. And then the narrative is, instead of them being uncivilized monsters, we have movie after movie after movie where it's like they are civilized after all. And it's meant to be like a pivoting point.
As you talk about that, because one of the big examples I think of as being a movie that represents negatively Arab culture that is a giant hit, you know, it's like it would have been great if this was a hit, is True Lies, you know?
Right.
So it's like in True Lies, guys like Mustafa or or Taj or whatever will be absolute bumbling dipshits.
Right.
But they will be,
they'd be comic relief and,
but not only that, they would be incredibly trained. So they wouldn't, you wouldn't even get a Taj. You're going to get like a Mustafa that's come back from the CIA thing and, and can one shot a helicopter out of the sky with an RPG, but then gets killed by Jamie Lee Curtis when she drops a gun down the stairs.
Yeah, chasing her lipstick or something like that. Right,
right?
She tripped on her high heels.
That's what I feel like was the prevailing at the time portrayal of Arab cultures and the Southeast Asia and stuff like that.
Yep.
Worse so than this. Like in this, it shows them, this is more... I'm curious to see what Rambo 3 did. I saw it as a kid, but I feel like Rambo 3 is probably a weird, wrongheaded companion to this movie, perhaps.
Yeah.
We're not going to
I feel like they're probably very similar in my mind, having not ever seen it. But the point about True Lies that I always make, Kate and I saw this in a theater once with subtitles, or in a hotel once, and there were subtitles on it. And when Schwarzenegger gives his... ID to get into the party at the beginning of this movie, he says something to the guard and the subtitles tell you what he says, and then it says imperfect Arabic underneath it, and it just killed us. It killed us because it was like very clearly Austrian, like accented Arabic, but not in subtitle land. It's like imperfect Arabic. But I want to go back to the scene where they're playing chess, because again, when he teaches him this, again, we've already talked about Samad's like sacrificial trope, like where he basically ends up like being evil for everyone and killed tragically. In this moment, he's not just like teaching this character something, he's literally giving him the key to his own survival, because he uses that word later when the women find him like crucified to the rock, right? And that's what keeps him from getting killed in that moment. So there's like two moments where this dude could have died before he ends up being the white savior. And in this instance, it's like Samad teaches him something, but it's also something that saves his life. It's like a very self-serving realization, right?
It's a economy of storytelling, you know?
Right. It's a very unidirectional economy of storytelling is kind of my point, but yeah, there it goes. Anyway, it's an amazing scene. And I thought that scene at night where they built the perimeter around the tank and they're all huddled in that tank and they don't know what's out there in the night,
so,
and they end up just torching a bunch of deer. That was pretty intense.
They get ambushed right here and they have to scurry into the tank and run off in a hurry. Another Molotov cocktail hits the top. They're blinded through their periscopes as the top of the tank is burning. They drive off. They leave behind all of their water and food.
Right. Rations.
They were trying to fix the track. They never got that done. So whatever like equipment that was there to fix the track got left behind. And then they're just out in the middle of the desert. And all of the guys run out and they put early warning devices down in the dirt. And then they sit down and watch the little radar thing, and there's bleeps all over it, and they're frickin' surrounded. They're all over us, man. They're in the room.
They're in the walls, man. It's read and write.
and Kovachenko's like, it doesn't seem like they're moving like they see us. And the other guys are freaking out. Yeah. And they're like, they're within RPG range, and it's like, it's all very tense, and Skull makes the decision for the turret to make a 360 shoot the coax machine gun in every freaking direction. It fires off like five different rounds, like at point blank at the ground in front of it, and just pisses out a stream of fire in a huge circle.
Stand by to traverse left, 360. All weapons fire at my command. Traverse! Fire!
He
And then
there's a very dramatic scorch mark on the ground in the morning.
and then Samad.
In case there was any doubt where the tank was last night, it's right here.
Samad is made to go and check to see how many people they killed. And he goes out there and he's very tense and he finds nothing but scorched dead deer. And yeah. While he's out there checking on it, Daskal orders Kovachenko to shoot him.
Right. Mm-hmm. And he does not.
Yeah.
He delays. We don't know if he doesn't refuse the order. What does he say? I don't know that he refuses it. He argues with him and then Samad gets back in before it's too late.
Well, he does say no.
Okay.
And there's like a heavy moment where all the air is like sucked out when he says no. And then Samad comes right back in there.
Yeah.
I missed a couple of things here right before they drive off when they get ambushed here. Kaminsky is getting drunk on brake fluid.
Right.
Kovachenko goes to write him up and Daskal tells him he's the best freaking gunner in the battalion. And right. So he won't be writing him up for one little thing, takes it out of his book, tears it up, throws it at him.
The one little thing being something that is mortally injuring the tank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to be pretty messed up. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you got a guy...
Positions...
Kaminsky is just willing to go right along with it, as we learn.
Yeah, Daskal is outside of authority. He's like his own little emperor in his own little world. I feel like power's corrupted the person. And this is him just living in his own little fiefdom.
This is where we learn that Kovachenko has been demoted a couple times. Uh-huh. We see that the Russian the tank has left. We see a scorched deer and the Afghanis show up. And one of them says the Russian kills just to kill.
And also because they're paranoid and fearful, but but seriously, who's keeping score? We don't like him, okay? We don't like him.
Now we have a scene that really bummed me out. We have Samad trying to pray.
And being told not to.
And he's being told not to. Daskal forbids it. Samad is like, why do you think I would betray you like my son is like in university? Like he's part of the party. I'm trying to do this thing. I have been nothing but loyal. What's going on? And Daskal just stares him down and tells him to go walk out in the water and tell him how freaking deep the water is.
Yeah. And Samad walks out there. Well, he asks him not how deep it is. He asks him, what's the bottom made of? And to me, it was like a really like potent metaphor because it's like, are we on stable ground or unstable ground? He says, is it stone or mud? And Samad says, stone. And that's when he gets it from behind. He thought it was stone, but it was mud, Charles.
Yeah, it was mud, as it turns out. Yep, he's killed by the gun on top of the tank, fired by Daskal, and Kovachenko just can't freaking understand it. Samad just goes floating down, and the tank just drives on down the river.
Yep.
And then we get a nice Daskal monologue here. This is where he says he doesn't think of himself, and he tells us about when he was an 8-year-old, he was lowered down from bridges with Molotov cocktails to stick into Nazi tanks, and they used to call him Tank Boy, and that back then people didn't question anything they gave of themselves, and that's what it's about.
The tank is not the villain. The tank is just war, right? It's the monster. And Daskal is, I think, the villain. And this is humanizing the villain, right? We're humanizing this person and giving him like a tragic backstory.
Yeah.
That potentially
he did fight the Nazis, and the Nazis are the worst of them all.
And it turns out we were the Nazis all along at the end. Like, what if we're the baddies? Is war in this instance, because fighting the Nazis is like something everyone's supposed to be a friend of, right? That's a great thing, right? Mm-hmm. Go get them. My question to you, Charles, is how is war working in this story? It's like Daskal,
he's been warped by it. I mean, it's a warping, experience. He experienced it as a kid, and he's continued doing it apparently his entire life. He's never stopped. I was trying to look up to see when the hell the Soviet Union was in Mongolia, and I couldn't quite tell, although I could tell that there was some weird kind of like communist incursion type stuff going on. So I don't know if there were Russian tanks with actual Russian crews there. Yeah. Who knows? But that was in the 60s. Otherwise, they were there in the 1920s. I think that's way too young because he's just a sperm at that point. A little spermy dropping Molotov cocktails into not Nazi tanks. Like,
So Descal's warning is that Bohr is going to warp you and distort you, and that
Descal's warning is that Kovachenko questioning stuff is a waste of dang time.
Yeah,
he's gumming up the works because you have a task to do, and that task is stopping the enemy that threatens the motherland.
But so far as the character is concerned, he's serving as a villain or foil to. Is it just again going back to like warning against like communist thinking and like being like he's a bad guy because he thinks that you're not allowed to think for yourself?
I don't even think it's communist thinking because he doesn't. I mean, he talks about the party and stuff, but at the same time, he talks in a completely American accent.
Right. And about giving and giving and giving.
And about giving, serving your country, you know, about serving and how you.
And that's too far. The movie is saying that's too far.
It's right? I think it's saying that when you just serve and you don't ask, then you find yourself doing an Afghanistan. Okay. And sadly, the movie never came out. And so we never got to see this. And what did we go and do?
In Afghanistan?
Yeah.
If you just serve and you don't ask, then you end up doing in Afghanistan. Did everybody get that? This is what the Patreon content is for, ladies and gentlemen. You're getting your dollar's worth right there. Whew, that's amazing. Okay. Thanks for sitting on that for a minute.
Yep. They say you admire them, don't you? And Kovachenko is saying that this is bullshit. Maybe they should... They question maybe that they should leave the tank and walk out. Yeah. Not a great idea.
He says he admired the freedom fighter when he was talking to Samad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? So he definitely does. He openly does.
He admired him particularly because that guy actually believed in what he was doing. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And Kovachenko can't believe in what he's doing because to him, like, he just doesn't see the point of this fight. Like,
he's just like going through the motions.
All he's seeing is just a cruelty upon people that can hardly defend themselves, except in this situation where they're actively hunting them. Kovachenko, for his trouble, gets tied to a rock. Can't trust him.
Yeah. And they put a grenade under his head. And the guy says, if you need anything, just nod.
What does Anton do on the tank? I guess he's not the driver. He must be like a loader or something. He's too cowardly to stop it. I think he is Stephen Baldwin. Mm-hmm. Kaminsky is just a freaking dope. The tank drives off, he's like, oh, it's so roomy in here. You made the good decision, Captain.
I think you did the right thing, sir.
I appreciate that, Kaminsky.
And I think I speak for all of us when I say that. The tank's roomier now, sir.
You're real
smart. The scene where they were kissing his ass after he tied that guy to a rock was just amazing.
Oh, my God.
Those guys are like Tweedledee and Tweedledum, and they're following Dr. Evil around in the tank. Like, they're just like your perfect like batch of idiots inside the most powerful tank in the world at the time, it would seem. I don't know.
A tank
not very likable.
Yeah, the tank we learn is totally wrecked. There is a quote, I believe, on the IMDb here for the Beast of War. We get a nice rundown of how ruined it is. Well, sir, the road wheels cracked. Kaminsky drank our brakes. We're low on petrol. The battery's low. We're losing oil. If the engine heats up, it's going to seize. The terrain, obviously, against us. We have no rations. The Mujahs behind us don't seem to run on rations, petrol, or anything we know of, and they have an RPG. Their aim is getting better, sir.
You're like, to be fair, that motorcycle probably runs on petrol.
The motorcycle is running on petrol. Yeah.
Definitely runs on petrol.
Yeah,
it's in bad shape.
Yep, it's running hard, and Duskull refuses to leave it behind. They just drive and drive and drive. I wrote here, Sharina wants to fight. What's going on here? Oh, and I wrote also, Uncle has to stay behind. This is a scene where the people are walking along. Yeah.
It's like 55 minutes into the movie where Sharina shows up and she's like, I want to fight. And they're like, nope, you can't. And I'm like, hey, there's actual speaking women in this movie.
She's
do
got
some
a bunch
things.
Of grenades. Yeah.
There's 55 minutes into the movie, very, very briefly. And it looks like a big pack of C4 or something. I don't know. Yeah. A big white cake or something. Yeah.
Nice. Uncle has to stay behind. I guess he dies.
Mm.
I don't know. We never see, the movie ends the way it does. We never see Taj go back and get him. I hope they got him.
He's just sitting out there all by himself at the scene at the end of the credits. Just like, hello?
No, you know what he's doing is, this is the uncle's scene later on in the movie. I seen you wit. I had you wit. That's what he said. I had you wit if he was a Jap. We go back to the tank, Kandahar Road. Can be seen that everybody's very excited about it. Duskal's like, see, I'm smart. I made the right choice. And then suddenly the tank
Afghanistan
has
is full of ha-has, apparently.
It's got a laugh. This is where that rope bridge that Danny built would have really helped.
Yeah, this is where that was, but they cut it down the last time a bunch of idiots came into Afghanistan, and they never replaced it, and so now you can't get over there from here.
Yeah,
in Scotland, they call them ha-has, where it looks like it's flat, but once you walk over there, it all of a sudden drops off, and there's no way across, and that's apparently what happens here. Mm-hmm. I was like, Afghanistan upside down? Because isn't it mostly, I mean, I'm sure that there's like ravines in Afghanistan, pretty mountainous, but this was like, just like a cliff. Like it looked
oh,
like
yeah,
the,
no, totally.
The, Grand
yeah,
Canyon
just a straight
style.
Up canyon. Yeah,
yeah.
It's the Canyon of the Crescent Moon, probably.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
so
they
that
can't
means,
get there from here.
Yeah. So the tank is just sitting there. They have to. They're pretty much out of petrol. The beast is bleeding fluids.
Mm-hmm.
This woman says the Afghan women come upon Kovachenko tied to the rock.
Mm-hmm.
And Sharina says, Afghan women turn your grief to stone.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to use
and
this
I really wish they would have killed him.
I was going to open up the podcast with this. Afghan women turn your grief to podcasting. Kovachenko calls for a sanctuary. He says the word. Mm-hmm. That Samad had taught him, and Taj comes in. Sharina is like, absolutely effing not. He just learned that, and he's using it because
he hasn't even done the reading.
Right, exactly. He barely knows what that means. He has no understanding of it. And Taj is like, nah, man, he did the thing.
He said the word.
Nanawatai, yeah. And and so they let him out, and then we go into the cave where everybody's hanging out. They show him how it works, their culture of where they have to show him mercy and give him sanctuary. Mm-hmm. Everybody chips in a little bit of food, and he gets to eat.
Mm-hmm. He gets to eat first, doesn't he?
He gets to eat first, actually. Yeah. And in the background, when Taj tells him to eat, Sharina goes, choke. I was like, yeah.
Team Sharina.
No, Sharina, marry me. Kovachenko... They have a whole scene where like he said, with the RPG, where he fixes the RPG for him. It has been having some problems. It's not a great piece of machinery. Kovachenko, as we briefly, very quickly, vaguely learned at the very beginning of the movie, is an RPG gunner.
Right.
So he apparently knows how to dismantle a very simple firing mechanism from the Lee Enfield into... I guess you can, because we saw it on the thing. I don't know. I have a Lee Enfield. I love to shoot it. My wife hates it. It's too big for her. It's great. It's a good gun.
God, I love that gun. You knew I'd like that gun. That's one of the nicest guns I've seen in a long time. I can't wait to shoot that fucker.
It's a lot of time spent in a cave staring at firearms and hoping that the Russian can fix it.
Hey, look, you're shooting in Israel. you're going to want to use one of them caves. Jesus Christ Superstar used it to great effect. They were like, we're shooting in Israel. We want to use some of these crazy caves you got. Shoot in there.
Right. It's also really important to emphasize that the technology is just not there with these folks. So what better way? Cave. when they're doing the rocks and planning it out at the end, it sounds like monkeys communicating because they're mostly using grunts and moving like stuff in the dirt. It's just
that's how again, we do it in the army. We call it a terrain model.
Yeah. No words, just grunts.
It does. I mean, in the army, it's no words, just expletives. So at least they just said the grunts, although maybe there was subtitles. Let's see what else.
The subtitles were all expletives.
Expletives. Yep. They ask Kovachenko if he's going to help him get that tank. Kovachenko thinks for a solid 5 seconds and he's like, yeah, I think I'm going to kill those fuckers.
Yep.
Wait, suddenly hold on. What did they do to me earlier? Oh, yeah. They tied me to the rock and they stuck a grenade under my head.
Yeah. He's now Team Afghanistan, but just for the sake of getting rid of the tank, because as soon as he gets his opportunity, he's like, yeah, helicopter me out of here, please.
Well, there was also, he had like one friend on the tank.
Right.
And that was Samad.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And he got blasted. Yeah. So it's like, he's like.
That's true. If Samad were still on the tank, then Kovachenko would definitely not have gone after it.
He probably not.
Would he have gotten kicked off if Samad were still on the tank?
He would have tried to get Samad off of the tank.
Yeah.
But I don't think Samad would have fared well. Well, no. I don't know. Man, there's a different movie where him and Samad just live in Afghanistan together. Let's see it.
It's like Sideways and about wine, except,
except it's Afghanistan about brake fluid.
About these,
So we go back to the tank. A chopper shows up. A Russian chopper has been out looking for water, and they spot the tank. The two crew members are very jazzed to see it. Daskal, less seemingly jazzed to see it.
Yeah, that was another text chat we had where I'm like, what is it about the soldier going back in? About the soldier not wanting to leave the fight or not wanting to leave the tank? Like, they have their chance to get out, and if they get out, they survive the war, but because they go back in, they don't survive.
So much in this case, Daskal's it's the villain doing pride it. Is tied right. to getting the tank back. I feel like it's almost like tied to that story where he's in Mongolia and he drives the tank back, you know, through huge adversity. He's like, I need to get this tank back because that's what Tank Boy get the tank back.
Tank Boy gets the tank back. I just saw this. The tagline for the movie is War Brings Out the Beast in Every Man. And I'm like, kind of, sort of. Is that what's going on here? He's turned into a monster? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like Daskal was pre-monstered before they showed up in Afghanistan.
From the very beginning of the movie, he's been... yeah, not exactly a complex character.
So in this situation, the chopper, they're like, hey, man, get in the chopper. Let's get out of here. And Daskal's like, no, we go in the tank. We don't go in the chopper. You're tankers. And the guys are like, what the hell? And he's like, get the fuel off of the helicopter and get in the freaking tank. And the guys in the chopper are like, man, you got to drive through the whole thing. Like, we flew over here, so we know map wise where you're at. You got to go all the frick the way back. Daskal's like, yeah, I know. And he goes, sits on top of the tank and just points the gun at the helicopter. And so the two crew members like grab like 5, 10, 15, 20 gallons of fluid, which will be enough to get them about out of the frame of the shot.
That's what was so surprising to me about the T-55 going like 300 miles is I'm like, where do they put all the fuel in that thing? Because it can't use that fuel very efficiently.
A lot of the time when you see pictures of T-55 type tanks, you'll see that there's like two big giant barrels kind of on the back.
And that's what that is. Yeah. Tank. Okay.
Yeah.
There you go. Just big 20 gallon.
Right. No, totally. Okay. Yeah. Two big 50 gallon things, I think.
The dude, the helicopter pilot, you see it for a really quick minute. He's super nonchalant. He's literally eating an apple. Mm-hmm. And I told you, it's like, tempting this feels like. Yeah. It feels like a very typical moment where the flyboys are always kind of like, don't give a damn or could care a little less. And they're always like a little more chilled and a little more relaxed.
He should have had like a cream silk scarf.
Yeah. Right, and just casually smoking
leather,
a cigarette.
The leather flappy cap that yeah. That has the little chin strap head dangling down with the goggles.
Right. But it was just this kind of little moment where it really emphasized to me just the difference between, like, range potentials, lifestyles. It made me think briefly, although I'm out of my depths here, I don't know who flies helicopters around, but it made me think of our Strategic Air Command movie where it's like we don't see a lot of troops in Strategic Air Command. And I'm like, I feel like these folks are on different levels, even if they're like the same level mm-hmm. officer-wise, just in terms of like the class system of how like flying for a helicopter unit works versus being a tank crew.
Oh, right.
It's like
yeah,
one of these people are in the dirt.
In the Army, so. The difference between a helicopter crew and a tank crew is mm-hmm. that the helicopter crew got 8 hours of sleep last night.
Yeah, and the tank crew burned a bunch of deer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So the two guys, Kaminsky and Stephen Baldwin or whatever, they walk back sadly back to the tank under threat of death. I said soldiers always perform under threat of death.
Yes,
and
they do.
The helicopter leaves. So that will be a, I guess that's a theme we're always going to be seeing.
Yeah, apparently thanks, but no thanks is not in the vocabulary of the Russian military.
The tank has to turn around. It is being observed by Taj and Kovachenko, two mm-hmm. best friends. And mm-hmm. they draw a little, Taj draws the map of the area in the dirt and tries to explain it very clearly to the Russian dude. Now, I have a story about this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because when you're saying this is dumb and stuff, let me tell you a dumb
story. They sound a little like monkeys. It's all grunts and grunts.
But it's like you can't say words, you know, because nobody understands your words. So when
they know tank and kaput, they've established this vocabulary.
They're getting there. Yeah. They're getting there eventually. When we were in Kosovo, we would go out on these patrols and it was always a treat when somebody showed up, a local showed up and they had a dog, because then you got to pet the dog and then try to make a conversation with somebody who didn't understand your language and you didn't understand theirs so that you could drag out this opportunity to pet a dog. And so this guy comes up and he's like a herder with cows and with cattle, and he shows up and we're petting his dog, and this guy Sergeant Kalunga is trying to make a small talk with him, and at one point he's looking at the herd of cattle and he says, how many? He's from like New Mexico or something. He's like, how many head of cattle do you have in this herd here? And the guy's just looking at him. He has no idea what the hell any of those words said. And and he's thinking for a second, and he goes, how many cows do you have? And the guy doesn't understand. And then Sergeant Kalunga thinks for a very seemingly long time, like, you know, just a few beats, though, and he goes, as if he's figured it out, and he goes, how many cows do you have?
Oh, my God.
And somebody started laughing, and they said, he's not going to understand you because you said it in his accent. And then somebody else said, but wouldn't it have been great if the guy said 20?
Yeah. If that would have worked, it would have been something else.
It would have been so, 20.
Yeah. 15. Funny.
I wonder now, what
now I know
you
what
wanted.
You're saying.
So that's real life
communication.
Experience. Communicating
not easy.
With people.
Mm-hmm. Not as simple as just putting on an accent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It helped that he made the map. He pointed at the tank. He did the thing. And then that dumbass Russian could be like, yeah, I get it now.
Nonverbal communication. Look at it operate. Look
Maps
at the power.
And math. The two things that don't
and need gestures.
And gestures.
And grunting.
And yelling.
Yeah.
Yelling English.
Expletives.
So they make a plan
the
for the
universal language of war. Sorry, what?
They make a plan for the ambush, which is what the women were doing for the last 25 minutes.
Yes.
The tank comes up on the old watering hole where the helicopter has landed. Mm-hmm. Guess what the tank or guess what the helicopter crew is doing? Just laying around.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're all
dead
because they poisoned it earlier in the dang movie.
Yep. Yep. There's really not a way to tell your team that you've also poisoned that water supply. Oops.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you didn't ride with them. Had they ridden with him, they could have told them, don't.
Just been like, yeah, don't do that. Is that something helicopters do, though, when they're in Afghanistan? Is it quicker to just land and drink out of the pond than to fly back to base and get some of that, like, government Dasani water? I know that's Russia, but...
I don't know what the supply chain was like in Russia apparently at the time. I'm telling you that when I was in Kosovo, Russians would seemingly do, like, bizarre, very bizarre things when it came to their equipment. You know, okay, like, you would have guys come in to your camp in a BMP that normally fits, like, 16 dudes in there, and there's four guys in there, and the whole back of it is just, like, covered in, like, Persian rugs and stuff, because they just live in there like it's a sex palace, and then... You'll have guys.
Do they have like a YouTube channel or something?
No, I don't know. And then you'll have Russians that will drunkenly wander into your room in the middle of the day and are willing to strip out of their uniforms completely right there in front of you if it means that they can trade that uniform for like a Discman. Yeah, I got a bunch of.
So they will land their helicopter for a quaff of poisoned water, is what we've.
I'm just saying that they have a weird supply line that, like, I can't give up a uniform, but apparently these guys can just strip out of a uniform and hand it to you and be like, cool, give me this Game Boy Advance. I'll give you this frickin' piece of equipment that normally for you would be get you in trouble if you gave it away. And so I don't know.
Maybe it's just something you can lose in Russia. It just happens all the time.
Yeah, I mean, they might
pretty
not.
Typical.
They might, yeah. I don't know. In any case, a big old mistake. Oopsie daisy.
Yep.
They picked the helicopters found.
Most of the Afghanistanis are happy with the helicopter, but Constantine wants revenge.
Yep, him and Taj wants revenge. Want to stay on task. And the other guys are like, hey, man, we got all of this stuff. This is great for our cause.
Right.
Pretty good case also.
Decent argument.
A decent argument. There. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Revenge just doesn't really stack up against, like, you know, actual material.
It would have been great if at the end of the movie, as he's flying away, he looks up and Mustafa looks out of the window of the helicopter. God, that would have been fucking great. So we have the showdown versus...
Plot twist.
It's like, oh, he doesn't know how to fly it. Shut up.
Wait, where are you taking me? And back to Kabul. Sorry, buddy.
Lands him right in the middle of the Tyson fight.
Just takes him to the village and drops him down the well. Oh, jeez.
Okay, so so now we have the showdown versus the tank. This is Taj and Kovachenko working as a very uncoordinated anti-tank team. This is why you train your crew-served weapons so that they work as a coordinated unit.
Yeah. You don't want the person with the rocket on the other side of the roadway from the person with the rocket launcher.
Yeah, you don't want to ever put yourself in a situation where the best case scenario, somebody's tossing a rocket to you. I mean, as I was telling you in text, as I was telling you in text, there is like a pin in the warhead of the RPG that you have to pull out to arm it. And sometimes in the heat of battle, people can forget that.
Yeah.
And so guys that I have known have like been driving through in patrols and had like those things lodge into the sides of their vehicles. And they shit themselves, they realize that the thing was just not armed. So
a huge part of them fighting the tank is them running up onto a ridge that is too high for the tank turrets and just letting the tank expend its ammunition. This seems to be the primary mode of engagement with the tank, because the rocket takes a long time to be used and doesn't actually seem to kill the tank.
They're just not great at it. It's like they have like one shot left with it. You know, it's already
the RPG introduced in the first act is somewhat meaningless.
it's definitely a threat enough to keep the tank moving.
There you go. Yeah, that's true. And it establishes Constantine as the savior trope.
But it's a false savior. Turns out we should have just trusted our women from the very beginning.
Women, explosives, and rocks.
He eventually, you know, it's like he's doing the trust the force moment. He aims the RPG. He fires it, and the RPG just hits the barrel of the tank. And so the barrel of the tank gets destroyed, takes all of the blast, and the tank itself is okay. And all of the guys on the inside cheer and cheer and cheer. And then suddenly the top of the pass explodes, and a whole bunch of giant boulders come down and just whack the tank and completely stop it in its tracks, and actually like destroy the tracks on one part, so you get a good mobility kill on the tank. It's out of ammo, and now the guys are just trapped inside,
and everybody else is taunting them using the tank boy line that we learned early on.
This is where the clinking happens, the clink 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 clink. And then they Molotov cocktail the tank. The tank catches fire. The guys are in the inside, and Duskal, you know, shows what a maniac he is. He just goes to the end. He's willing to just grab a grenade and stick it on his chest and blow himself up right there on the inside of the tank.
Take everybody with him,
Take everybody with him. And his two guys in there finally resist him. When it comes to saving their lives, they run over and
the word is stop convenient.
They stick the pin back in there and then they climb out of the tank, surrendering to everybody. So the guys come back out of the tank. People, you know, take what they want from them. They're not allowed to kill them.
Right.
And we have some moments here. We have Kovachenko talking to Duskal and laying out kind of the point of the movie, I suppose. Are we the Nazis?
Are we the baddies? Yeah, that seems to be it. It's just this like reconcile
just because,
moment.
Yeah, just because you fought Nazis back in the day doesn't mean you're not a Nazi now.
You can't actually become a Nazi now. Yeah, the person who plays Duskal is George Zunza, is how I think you might say this name. And he seems super familiar to me, and I'm looking at his IMDb right now. He was definitely in Crimson Tide, which is one of my favorite submarine movies ever. He's really, really good in it. He's very bit party, but he's in it. He's also played the voice of Perry White in Superman a lot, which I think tells you a lot about the kind of actor that this person is in a couple of times this has happened. Just really good. Right. We also said he's got Tim Robbins in the basement in War of the Worlds vibes. He's got real heavy, like whacked out Tim Robbins vibes for me. And they basically send him off into the desert, and he walks off down the road. And once again, he's got to take a fork in the road. But this one doesn't seem to really matter either way.
This one doesn't seem to matter.
He's going
to
get chased down.
He's going
to
get chased down.
And we don't ever see his death. We just see the Afghanistan women come back covered in blood.
We see the other guys run off, and we hear the sound of rocks kind of hitting them and stuff. And then we see Sharina, or what her name is, and she's covered in blood. And she says, "I apologize. Two of them got away. Oopsie daisy."
Yeah. So I guess we don't even know that Duskal died, because we don't know who got away. Three of them were left at the end.
That's true. Maybe they just held Duskal right there and told him to wait. And then they ran after those two other guys and then just chose one at random.
Yeah, it's hard to know.
I like to think that Duskal and Kaminsky got away, the two shitheads, and Stephen Baldwin actually got stoned to death at the end.
Interesting choice, though, because typically the movie is, if it's going to set up the bad guys so dramatically in the beginning, it's going to really relish in their death at the end. And that's the whole point of tilting the scale that far, is to give them a very spectacular death. And that this movie just puts that off camera, and only the remnants and the story gets told through the lens of the women. That's a different choice for a war movie. And I'm not exactly sure how it's working right now, but I just think it's worth kind of looking at for a minute.
Especially after you saw somebody get this like absolutely splattered on the thing.
So after they established that those dudes, two of them got away and one of them got splattered all over the Afghanistan and women, the helicopter, a different helicopter shows up and decides to pick up Constantine. And you promised to tell me why Taj is sad. Why is Taj sad? They've had very little bonding. They basically just ran through the desert. The dude fixed his bazooka and then dragged him around, helped him avoid a tank.
Well, look.
What am I missing?
Look, Constantine, his friend, is gone. some odd.
It sounds like he calls him brother at the end. The subtitles cut out for me, but when he shouts, it sounds like he calls him brother.
They probably said and hermano.
It's like where they, I mean, I get it, like war forges the bonds of brotherhood and all of that. Is that what they're doing? Like,
well,
they
I said it also
fought
in the,
together.
In the text
so now they're
that, like, also all of his friends probably mostly dead. His town mostly wiped out. His brother, his,
like his
literal
only.
Brother, has been smashed on the ground. And then he's got this other guy who trusted him pretty much from the beginning when everybody else from his town was questioning his authority. And
well, he didn't really
guys,
have a choice to trust him, though, did he? Because he was kind of a captive, wasn't he?
He was kind of a captive, but he's like, I mean, if you're...
I like this guy.
Hey, he didn't kill me.
As a leader, I like you.
I don't know. I think that's I think it's one of those situations. You just met somebody cool as hell. Look at this thing you went through, man.
In the big parade, you said that Jimmy Apperson is attractive because all of the other men in France have been killed, and that's the only possible explanation we have for why that love story starts, and it's kind of a similar argument here. That would have to be about it. It's like
everybody else
is gone, so you're the only friend I got.
Yeah, kind of. It kind of is, but it's like,
it
you
is
know,
so
it gets
dramatic.
You,
it is
gets you,
so
it gets you so
like,
much.
It's like,
it,
I'm like, there's a brief moment where I'm like, are they in love? Like, what's going on?
Well, kind of. It's like Speed. Like,
right?
I almost feel like it's like Speed, where it's like, you know, the when you get those romances in
see,
extreme situations.
If it had
situations,
come down that way, I would be a big fan of this movie, but that's not what they're doing. It's just weird. And then he takes the longest, most dramatic exit in cinema history. The jazzy whale cat comes back, and we just watch this dude like Cirque du Soleil dangle from a helicopter.
He doesn't
all
have
the, way
the
up
RPG.
The valley.
He doesn't have an AK-47.
No.
He doesn't have an Enfield. He has one of those incredibly ornate Afghani muskets, and he's carrying that as he is carried away by the helicopter.
Why? It's like he's like an angel lifting into the sky. but he's taking their gun. Why is he holding that gun?
He's part of, I don't know, I think he's stuck between two worlds now.
Yeah. I'm taking this.
He's,
this is
he's
going
truly,
up on my wall.
He's truly stuck between two worlds because he's dangling between the helicopter and the earth.
Yeah, it's very literal in that case, isn't it?
And then the movie
just like
ends. He flies off
ends.
And it
just
flies
away. What happens after that? We don't know.
Yeah,
well,
they
so,
got the uncle.
The Soviets leave and America shows up. And basically just the same thing.
Just remake the movie with a different tank.
Except, yeah, with a different tank and a lot of Humvees. And yeah, it's basically the same thing. Yeah, so I don't know, man. This movie was so intense, and it's a great horror movie. It's like an 80s horror movie that's like a just brutal war movie. I don't know. The brown face is over the top. The fetishization of Afghanistan looks a lot like it did in the last movie, just with more like contemporary overtones, I think. But it's amazing. Again, $8 million to make it, $160,000 recouped because there was like a fight in the studio, you'd said, and so it didn't get released.
It was like it's like a leadership changeover apparently in the top executives, and so usually when that happens, usually there's some kind of animosity or something that's going on, and a lot of projects that were the babies of the previous administration get shelved when that sort of thing goes on. So I believe that's what happened in this movie.
Okay. So I have one kind of thing I want to do before we go, and it may work, it may not. You were on a Humvee. Mm-hmm. How many people were in that crew?
Three.
Three people?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we get lots of soldiering. We've seen soldiers in airplanes. We've seen soldiers in World War I trenches. We saw the folks from Glory. This is our first, besides like Strategic Air Command, right? This is our first like ground vehicle crew movie, right?
I think so, yeah.
It's like they typically don't get along, but they're on the same side because they're facing mortal threat. I feel like there's always the kind of horny porno ogling of women bonding moment. I feel like you get you definitely get division. There's definitely a traitor in the midst, or someone suspects a traitor in the midst. Do you see what I'm doing here? Like, there's just all of these, like, and so my question was, Charles, were you the traitor in the midst? Is that who you were on the Humvee? Is that, like, your, like, but, like, but, like, no, like, what, like, soldier chemistry and all that shit, right? Like you knew the three people in your Humvee pretty well?
Yeah.
And you'd been in basic, since then at least, or? Like, how long have these guys known each other? How's this look?
Potentially a long time, but Kovachenko is like a new dude in, it seems like. I mean, it seems everybody's pretty familiar with Daskal through reputation.
Yeah.
Kaminsky has reputation in battalion as being a good gunner, so it's hard to tell how long they've all been together in this thing. I don't know how long their term of service was in the military when they went in.
But considering this was made by Americans, right?
Like, when we were on our vehicle, like, we had been around each other so long that, like, we could go through literal days out in the field and not have to say a word to each other. Yeah. You know, and it wasn't because we were mad or anything like that. It was just because we had heard everybody's stories a million times before, and we knew literally everything that needed to be done, and it could be done without saying anything. Or sometimes the opposite would happen, where we're talking a lot, but literally everything we're saying is completely negative, like roasts and mean things, and none of it of any substance, where people are like, are you guys mad? It's like, no, we've just run out of things to say, and this is how we're talking to each other this week. And so, but we were a lot tighter. Like, we didn't normally have, at least not in our platoon, we didn't really have crews that freaking hated each other for the most part. You tried to avoid that, you know.
Yeah.
But also, so there's times when you can't do anything about it.
You were injured when? In 2008?
Three.
Have you talked to them since then? Like, communicated at all?
Like, Swartz, you catch up with them? Yeah, I talked to the other guys, like, at least annually.
It's a different, like, place for us to put this kind of, like, character analysis of, like, what makes a soldier and why are they in there and all of that. And I feel like it's almost always antagonistic, but they've always got each other's back. This movie situates one person very cleanly on the outside. Like, Constantine seems to be on the outside from the very beginning. Mm-hmm.
But he says at the end that he's just trying to be a good soldier. And that means questioning these things. And he's right.
He's not a patriot, and he doesn't have his guys' back. So he's got Samad's back, but that's it.
It's like, it depends on, I guess, what do you think is being a patriot? Is being a patriot just obeying and giving, as Daskal says, or does being a patriot mean that you embody supposedly what your country's ideals stand for? And should those ideals not be that you have to put a stop to the destruction of a village that can't defend itself?
We don't get any of the principled arguments, right? Like, for me, you're right, that the patriotism line is typically one of principle, and it's about, this is what our country is about, or it's about the flag, or it's about the homeland, or something like that.
And people are confused as to what that means. You know, it's like where they say, patriotism doesn't mean just militarily winning. If that's the case, then you want to be Kaminsky, just following orders and firing the gun. But if it means that holding yourself up to a higher standard, which I believe is what soldiering is supposed to be and what being a police officer is supposed to be, is that you're held to a higher standard and you should be expected to live by it, even if it means putting yourself in personal danger. And sadly, a lot of guys don't do that. Kaminsky doesn't do that. Daskal doesn't do it.
Contradictory and, I think, mutually exclusive myths here, though. There's one that says the soldier police officer is supposed to be held to a higher standard, but then there's another one that says you got to back the blue, you got to support your friends at all costs, no matter what. Mm-hmm. You get it? And that's what I'm really teasing at here, is that it's like, in a lot of other movies, Constantine is terrible because he does not charge when his friends charge. He doesn't have their back. He abandons them and fights for the other team and tries to kill them. And from the very beginning, the movie says they're all a bunch of shitheads. But, like, my point is just that it's like a lot of the other movies that we've seen, the whole point is, like, the thing that gets them to charge, the thing that gets them to stand up and face that moment of mortal danger, is the person next to them. right? We've said that again and again and again. And I think we've even said you don't even have to like that person. So it's not about whether you like that person or not. It's more just about, like, this is our situation and we're in this unit and we're in it together. And he violates all of that from the very beginning. And it is because the other people are terrible. And so, again, it comes back to this, like, very American story of this revolutionary that we don't even abide by in this country, by the way, because our soldiers do some of the worst fucking shit in the world, you know, and then we protect them. And it's like, but the point is just that it's like, we want the individual. For us, it's all about you're the soldier. You're the individual is the soldier in this movie. And he is the cause. And as long as he's principally in support of what they're doing, then he's going to do it. And if not, he's not. It just seems like a weird position for him to be in. And the fact that he's a Russian, I guess, makes him get away with it. Would it play differently if those were Americans in that tank crew? You get it? And they're all a bunch of assholes, and he sides with the Mujahideen and decides to blow up an American tank crew at the end. You get it? Like, would that have played the same way?
There's some movie. I don't think it would have worked. There's a movie I just watched the trailer to, and eventually we're going to get to it.
It's kind of like Dances with Wolves, I guess. But
it's called. There's a movie called Kill Team that's about the Iraq War, and it's one of the characters in there seems to be questioning the morality of what they're doing, and he seems to be getting othered by then his unit in Iraq. Yeah. I don't know. It says, like, kind of inspired by true events. I don't know if it's inspired by Pat Tillman or not.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. God, that's a movie that needs to be made the right way, and that will probably get made the wrong way if it hasn't already.
The right way, of course, is that he got killed fighting the Kandahar giant, and then it was covered up because a biblical monster cryptid is supposed to be kept secret from the United States public. And so they faked that he was actually a secret leftist and he was friendly fired, because in reality he was killed by a giant spear.
Once you learn the Kandahar giant, it's just a few steps away from the world's flat. Like, it's just, can't let any of that get out. Like Dances with Wolves, you kind of see this, I think, where it's like the Union Army is the evil one, and so we're gonna fuck them up, and the movie wants us to side with not America. I don't know. It's just interesting. Well, we got one more movie in this batch. Charles, do you want to tell us what it's going to be?
Mm-hmm.
So we've watched The Man Who Would Be King, and that was very much about Afghanistan in the 1880s. And then we watched the B3AST. Something about the 80s. They're like, we're going to reverse a letter to make it look techie. It feels like something that they would do, I wanted to say for Short Circuit, even though that one doesn't have any like numbers in the name. It just feels like a kind of techie thing, and it felt kind of out of place. The poster also had a star on the A of the word beast, and that felt weird to me, because when I see a star, I think of America, and I know there's a star on the Soviet flag. Fine. But it just seemed like, I don't know, it just seemed kind of disjointed in the way they put it together. Is it another Afghanistan movie, dare I ask?
Well, before we get into this, let me just say, I recommend this movie. I wasn't expecting this. This was bizarre. I don't know where the hell this movie came from. I don't know why it... I mean, I guess technically I know why it's under the radar, but it's a shame that this is under the radar. It has its heart, I think, in the right place, even though it fails on other things. You shouldn't have a Cuban or an Indian or an Israeli playing Afghanis. You know,
we can
just cast people of the thing now. We're getting better with it. This movie is surprisingly only like 10 years after Man Who Would Be King. When you said that was like shocking to me. I was like, wait, what?
It's really shocking.
Yeah.
This movie feels like it's from the 90s. I keep saying that.
And it
that
feels
may not mean much
way
to some
more
of our
modern.
Younger listeners.
Right.
But
that
yeah.
may still seem totally old to a lot of people. But right. Aaron and I right. are sadly getting there.
Right. It holds up. It's got a lot of standpoint problems, a lot of representation problems. But as far as like war movies that you've probably never seen, that has all of the trappings of the conventions that you see in terms of, again, the kind of gritty realism of the Black Hawk Down and like Saving Private Ryan stuff. It's got a lot of that. It's
humanizing the opponents, you know, like,
right.
It's
right.
It shows the brutality that is wrought upon innocent civilians. You know, I feel like it does a lot of things right. If you're going to do a war movie that doesn't glorify the war, I guess this is it. It didn't feel like it was glorifying fighting so much.
It doesn't glorify it. I think it glorifies war. I think it positions war again as like a kind of neutral power. Again, it's not so much the tank that's the enemy. It's the person that's driving the tank. And we're cheering for the warriors on the other side. And ultimately, it's Constantine who has the technology which is a war technology.
I feel like we should be cheering for Tosh to not have to ever fight again, is what the story of
that. I mean, that, right. Yeah.
I feel like it's kind of there, not enough, because it is, sadly, war movies are going to be kind of action movies. So they got kind of actiony at the end, but I feel like it landed it a bit better than other ones we're going to come into later on.
Eventually, it's more horror than action.
Yeah.
Like, it feels a lot more like a horror movie than an action movie.
And I think that's
it's
the
definitely
right direction.
Not anti-war, but it doesn't come off as pro-war as much the rest of the 80s stuff, that's for sure.
It doesn't come off as pro-war as like the way Glory does.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, Glory like revels in the religious experience of war. We said this positions it as like a weird monster fantasy.
Right. I think had this had the more of a Glory vibe, I think Kovachenko at the end would have maybe felt a bit more like a winner instead of a guy that looked very confused as he got lifted out of there. Confused and exhausted as he left. I mean, probably to get executed.
I was listening to that Batch episode, and you'd said that Glory would have been amazing if they would have put Shaw on trial like they do at the end of Paths of Glory. Just like, oh my God. Because that's what the Confederates did to that dude, we said in that episode. That is definitely what they did to him, except it was after he'd been killed. But okay. Anyway, what's next?
So, you're not going to like it. We were going to go to, well, maybe you will. Who knows? I don't know your taste. We're going to go to 2013, and we're going to enjoy Peter Berg's Lone Survivor.
Here it is. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Got to do it sometime.
I have not seen this movie. I've definitely avoided it on purpose. Okay. but this is why we're here, Charles.
I watched a little bit of it today. I've watched it once before. I don't remember liking it. I watched some of it today, and
it's going to make me mad.
We're going to have a lot to talk about, but it is already... interestingly pairing up with this one that we just finished. So,
yeah, I do. I feel like it's going to have a lot to say with regards to who we are, what America's role is in Afghanistan. I think it's going to pair really well because we said that the beast of war is like, this is who America is in Afghanistan, right? Even though they don't even know that yet. And Lone Survivor is going to be like, nope, 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 nope. That's not who we are. Mm-hmm. Like, we are definitely not that. And it's going to be, I think you're right, a really good pairing. The one thing I will say about this movie, and it's a silly note, but Ben Foster is in this movie, and Ben Foster has a very, very particular look. Mm-hmm. He's in The Messenger. He's also in 310 to Yuma. But he's also to me, he's just like the perfect steely-eyed, like, bad guy. I don't know. Like, he's just perfectly cast. Just for this movie, if you want this kind of like arrogant, despicable, gun-shooting, ruthless killer, he's just perfect for it. And ever since I've seen the trailer for this movie, I'm like, yeah, I know that guy. He seems well cast.
He could have been a hot, sexy, young heartthrob, and he chose not to do that, seemingly. He chose a bunch of weird roles along with other things, and has built this strange persona as a steely-eyed guy with a beard. Cool. I have not seen The Messenger. That looks like a bummer. We'll eventually watch that.
I'm sure we will. Okay. Well, we got one more movie for this batch, and then we'll do a batch episode. I'm looking forward, Charles.
Okay,
thanks,
Aaron.
Man.
Yep. Thank you.
Podcast about the narrative and effective politics of war movies and their productions too. Charles Horgan and Aaron Donaldson bring you a brand new podcast, The Real War Project. Dip in and out of subjects with Lauren and Sarah's irreverent points of view with the hilarious podcast, Dippers. Catch up with the week's pop culture news as well as reviews of new movies and shows, not to mention the occasional interview with Carl, Brandon, and Biggs on Not Safe for Network. Wrestlers wrestle, but sometimes they make movies too. This podcast lets you know how they do. Listen to Eric and Connor in all three seasons of Movies with Wrestlers. One by one, Jeremiah and Biggs break down influential movies and some wretched ones too in the podcast you can't miss, A Cosmic Void.